A working theory about the Ukrainian plane crash. A missile may have accidentally shot it down in Tehran. Also, President Trump said he had good reason to order the killing of Qasem Soleimani, but scholars say a legal justification cannot be made after the fact.
It is absolutely essential for the functioning of our democracy that that legal analysis be done.
And a former senior NATO official describes the Trump administration's Mideast policy.
I think policy is a bit of an ambitious word when it comes to the Trump administration's overall approach to the region, quite frankly.
Also today, Harry and Meghan's great escape.
The openness about a division between the palace and between Harry and Meghan is breathtaking.
I'm Marco Werman. All that coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The crash of Ukrainian International Airlines Flight 752 in Iran on Tuesday night remains a mystery, but some theories are emerging. U.S. intelligence officials are expressing high confidence that the plane may have been mistakenly shot down by an Iranian missile. The flight from Tehran to Kiev had 176 people on board. Many were Canadian citizens and residents. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau addressed his country this afternoon.
We have intelligence from multiple sources, including our allies and our own intelligence. The evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile. This may well have been unintentional.
President Trump also spoke to reporters today. He did not assign blame or a cause for the crash, but Trump said he has his suspicions.
It was flying in a pretty rough neighborhood, and somebody could have made a mistake. Some people say it was mechanical. I personally don't think that's even a question.
Patrick Smith is an airline pilot and runs AskThePilot.com. I asked him what he thought of the missile theory.
Well, things are definitely trending in that direction, and this is something that was suspected in many circles from the start. And there seems to be a gathering amount of evidence that that is what we're dealing with. Of course, Iranian authorities are not being particularly forthcoming and withholding the black boxes. That's definitely a complication, but not entirely unprecedented. If you remember back to the MH17 shootdown, getting hold of the data from that accident was a bit of a project. Normally, when a U.S.-built airplane is involved in an incident like this, the NTSB and Boeing will receive the data recorders. It looks like, with geopolitics being what they are, that that's not going to happen. But the Iranian authorities are willing to share the recorders and other information with Canadian authorities, Swedish authorities, Ukrainian authorities. So I think one way or the other, we'll get to the bottom of this. You know, meanwhile, it's fascinating in a way that there's a tie-in here. You have a Ukrainian jetliner, and Ukraine, of course, no stranger to shootdowns of commercial aircraft. The MH17 disaster a few years ago took place over Ukraine.
Right, Malaysia Airlines.
The seventh deadliest accident in aviation history. And in Iran, in 1988, you had the USS Navy cruiser Vincennes shooting down the Iran Air Airbus. That's the eighth deadliest air disaster in history. And now both of these countries involved in this disaster. It's certainly curious.
Are you skeptical of Iran's claim that the plane suffered engine failure?
Well, engine failure, that can mean different things. But an engine failure, even of a very serious kind, say an uncontained engine failure where pieces of the engine's internal components pierce the fuselage or the wing, even a very worst case engine failure is extremely unlikely to cause an accident, especially one where the plane was reportedly in flames before it hit the ground. I'm not seeing that.
So if this theory turns out to be true, it'd be pretty shocking. And as you say, it takes us back to that Malaysian Airlines MH17 that was shot down over Ukraine in 2014. Do you think this could be starting to happen more often, and do regulations need to change?
Well, it ties into the geopolitical conflicts around the world. I mean, the more of them that there are and the more sophisticated kinds of weaponry that is utilized in these conflicts and skirmishes, it increases the likelihood of this sort of thing happening. On top of that, you have more and more airplanes flying than ever before. So statistically, the likelihood of this does go up.
Airline pilot Patrick Smith of AskThePilot.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
In Canada's Iranian community, people are mourning the victims of the crash. The theory of an Iranian missile shooting down the plane only adds to their grief.
Unfortunately, it's not surprising from that regime. And it's also going to fuel some anger against the regime, or resentment even more so.
Peyman Parsian is active in the Iranian Heritage Society of Edmonton. He told us about a vigil held in his city last night in memory of the victims.
Many of the Iranian community members that were there, knew somebody that was on that flight. And so it's very upsetting. One way or another, everybody was trying to mourn together. It was really supported from the city side. Many non-Iranians were there. Our police service showed up. Many politicians showed up. So it was a lot of support.
I know some of the victims from Edmonton included a married couple, professors at the University of Alberta. Can you tell us about them and how the community is mourning them?
The professors and their two little girls, the 9 and 14-year-old girls, were very much a fabric of our community. She was leading many projects in the engineering department, and she was awarded with being one of the women in leadership in the engineering role within our university, while he was working on new technologies within the engineering department. He was very well known. Those two will be missed, along with all of the other 25.
Talk about the Iranian-Canadian community in Alberta. How large is it? Is it close-knit?
The estimate for in Alberta is about 15,000. In the city of Edmonton, the most up-to-date numbers that we use are from 2016, showing 2,700 Iranians in Edmonton. So there's other areas in the country, of course, like Toronto and Vancouver, Montreal, which have much higher populations. But one advantage we had was that we were very united, and it made us very much like family.
I mean, the numbers of Iranian Canadians are not huge, but proportionally, Canadians with Iranian roots make up about 1% of the country, I saw. In Alberta and Edmonton, when did the big migration of Iranians happen? Was it after the 79 revolution?
It would have been likely more to do with the university programs, the oil and gas development. It's estimated in a report that was released about a year ago that a quarter of the Iranians that are in Edmonton, or in Canada, sorry, are engineers. Our University of Alberta here in Edmonton is very well known and is world renowned in many engineering aspects. And so because Iran, being a player that produces disproportionately high number of engineers, meets a university that's very well known in engineering, inevitably there'll be a higher number in that field. That's part of the reason why that flight had so many international students on it.
Right. I mean, one element of the story is that there are a lot of restrictions right now on travel between the U.S., Canada, especially Vancouver and Toronto, and Iran. How has that impacted how people are able to travel to Iran?
There are no direct flights from Canada to Iran from any point. And so it forces anyone traveling to connect anywhere. Now, if you have a Canadian passport, you have a lot more options. You can travel through many European transit states, you can travel through Dubai, Seattle kind of flights. But if the international student, someone without a Canadian passport, wanted to, they can't. And so it limits their possible options.
Peyman, in the backdrop of this terrible crash, of course, is everything going on between the U.S. and Iran. Is there general anxiety in Canada's Iranian community right now about that?
Of course. There's a lot of unease and worry for loved ones and family members in Iran. And it had us glued to the TVs during the retaliation that Iran, when they were launching the ballistic missiles towards the U.S. bases. And so part of the reason why we were privy to the breaking news of this plane going down was it happened amidst of all that action. So while we're all watching this news about the retaliation, the plane news gets dropped on everybody. And, you know, you're trying to soak it all in. It was a rough 48 hours for the community.
Peyman Parsian in Edmonton. He's the former president of the Iranian Heritage Society of Edmonton. Peyman, again, our condolences to you, to everybody there, and thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
As you heard, the crash of the Ukrainian plane happened on the same night that Iran stood on the brink of conflict with the United States. The fundamental problems between the U.S. and Iran remain unresolved. Today, President Trump expanded on an idea he floated yesterday, that NATO helped the U.S. in the Middle East. The president's remarks to reporters were somewhat incoherent, off the cuff, and occasionally inconsistent with the facts. But he did say this.
And I actually had a name. NATO, right? And then you have ME, Middle East. you'll call it NATOMI. I said, what a beautiful name. NATOMI. I'm good at names, right? USMCA. Like the song, YMCA.
In a scripted speech yesterday, Trump also called on the European partners to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal to abandon the agreement. For a European perspective on this, we called Fabrice Potier in Brussels. Potier headed up policy planning for two NATO secretaries general. He's now a senior fellow with the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Potier says Europeans like him view the events of the past week with surprise and concern.
Concerned because you had a pretty quick escalation between the United States and Iran, a surprise attack by the United States in killing one of Iran's top generals. So I think they were holding their breath to see what's next. Clearly, yesterday, President Trump has called it a draw, and both countries seem to be willing to de-escalate, or at least no longer escalate. So that's the good news in that pretty intense last few days. But I think everybody is holding their breath on what's next in terms of potential escalation. I'm not sure Iran has said their last word. And also on what does President Trump really want? Does he really want Europe to step in and to do what?
Do you have an understanding of what the Trump administration's policies are in the Mideast?
I think policy is a bit of an ambitious word when it comes to the Trump administration's overall approach to the region, quite frankly. I think it's made of sudden moves, very transactional approach. But the deeper trend, however, and the one that is more worrying, is I think there's a general retrenchment of the United States from the region.
Let's look specifically at the Iran nuclear deal. France, along with the other European partners, Germany and the UK, was one of the six nations that helped negotiate the JCPOA with Iran. Why is France sticking with the deal?
Well, it's not only France, quite frankly. I think the UK is also sticking with the deal. Germany, China, Russia. Don't forget that China and Russia have also signed the deal. I think everybody is sticking with the deal because so far it was the best or the least bad option to make sure that Iran will not go nuclear. Now, clearly, the U.S. administration decided to exit the deal and, by a sense, to undermine it. And now we are seeing, I think, some outcome of that decision, which is Iran is crossing some of the red lines containing the deal by deciding to increase some enrichment of uranium. And Iran has clearly stepped up its regional dangerous activities. So I think the deal was maybe not perfect, did not cover Iran's regional activities, which are problematic, but at least there was something on the table that kept Iran sitting at the table, if you want. Now Iran has left the room, and I think we are a bit without any means to bring them back into negotiation.
So yesterday, Trump also made an appeal to NATO.
Today, I am going to ask NATO to become much more involved in the Middle East process.
So, Fabrice Potier, how can NATO help in the Middle East?
Well, at first, what does President Trump really mean here? Does he mean NATO getting in the Middle East to do more fight against terrorism? I think potentially there could be some support for that among Europe and allies, mostly by training local forces, for example. Or does he mean using NATO to contain and deter Iran? And here it's a totally different ballgame. And I think him having talked about NATO yesterday in the context of his statement on Iran is probably making a lot of European allies very nervous, because the last thing they are ready to do is to use NATO to basically deter against a regional power like Iran.
Fabrice Potier, former head of policy planning under two NATO secretaries general. He joined us from Brussels. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The toll in Australia has been devastating. Fires have killed 27 people since September. Some 1 billion animals have also been killed or injured. That's billion with a B. And thousands of homes have been destroyed. Many people want to know if this is the new normal. Well, after a few days of cooler temperatures, the country is bracing again for a spike in fire conditions starting tomorrow. Prime Minister Scott Morrison dedicated $40 million to communities recovering from the fires this week.
The scale of the disaster is enormous, and it is a reminder of the terrible threat that nature provides in this country. And we will continue to seek to match that as best as human beings are able to do.
As the country burns, some Australians are saying Morrison isn't doing enough to fight the fires. But the Prime Minister and his allies say the criticism is a distraction from the emergency at hand.
There's been a lot of blame being thrown around, and now's a time to focus on the response that is being made. Plenty of people have blamed me, people have blamed the Greens, people have blamed... who knows? Honestly, blame doesn't help anybody at this time.
Scientists say the record-breaking levels of hot and dry weather fueling the fires are partly due to climate change. And with the fires as a backdrop, many activists are making a connection between Australia's own carbon emissions and its increasingly devastating fire seasons. Those activists are pushing for a move away from coal and oil and toward renewable energy sources. Tomorrow, more than 10,000 climate protesters are expected in cities across Australia. Chloe Rafferty is organizing one of those protests.
We're calling for Scott Morrison to be sacked. Our Prime Minister is a disgrace. He is more committed to the coal industry of this country, the coal billionaires, than he is to saving lives in Australia and stopping mega fires. We're calling for a fully funded professional firefighting service and to fund the volunteers that are currently battling the fires. And we're calling for a just transition, an immediately enacted just transition to 100% renewable energy, which is really what we need to see to stop climate-driven weather catastrophes.
As for the fires right now, I know your group has been critical of Prime Minister Morrison's response to the fires. How does the government response to the fires relate to their own climate policies?
Scott Morrison's shown total disdain from the beginning of this fire season, which started before summer, through to now, and just the constant refusal to acknowledge the link between Australia's own emissions and the mega fires. When he does, it's just kind of lip service to the question of climate change. He refuses to acknowledge the connection between the massive waste of water towards fossil fuel projects. So these are the factors that are driving why we're experiencing such a vicious fire season this season. And all Scott Morrison wants to talk about is thoughts and prayers and communities coming together.
Government officials, I know, have asked you not to protest on Friday. They say fire risk is high and emergency services are needed elsewhere, including the police, that would be kind of monitoring the protests. Here's Victoria Environment Minister Lily D'Ambrosio yesterday.
The last thing we need is for our emergency services personnel to be deviated or distracted by what is a well-meaning protest that I understand has been planned, but those resources need to go where the highest priorities are.
So, Chloe, what is your response to that?
That's a very political response from an increasingly authoritarian government that does not want to see climate change protesters. But right now people are angry and they know we're only going to get action to help the fire-affected communities, and we're only going to see action in place for next fire season if people come out on the streets.
I mean, but the way the Australian fire services are organized, I mean, it's volunteer. I mean, isn't there a risk that you could be taking away crucial services that might be putting out those flames if you're protesting and they're in these big cities?
No, I totally reject that. I think that, like, personally, my mum and dad are stuck in a fire-affected community that they haven't been able to leave. And they will be following our protest closely and very much supporting them. I reject the idea that the very angry people in these communities who have lost lives and lost homes do not want to see action taken to hold the government to account for the impact that they have had on creating such a catastrophic fire season.
So are you going to call off the protest?
Absolutely not. This is exactly the time that we need to see mass action. I really encourage people in the US, people in the UK, people around the world who also have been following Australia's fires to take protest action at your nearest climate action demonstration as well. We'll be having rolling protests all summer.
Chloe, do you think that the people of Australia are at the point with these fires where they would push for Prime Minister Morrison's resignation over his climate policies?
I think the tens of thousands of people that came to the last protest that Uni Students of Climate for Climate Justice organised, 40,000 in Sydney and tens of thousands around the country, I think that speaks to the intense anger felt around the country.
Chloe Rafferty with the group Uni Students for Climate Justice speaking with us from New South Wales. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
While the eyes of the globe were turned to the Mideast this week, Puerto Rico has been rocked by earthquakes. On Tuesday, a 6.4 magnitude quake struck, becoming the strongest to hit the island in 102 years. Hundreds of homes have been destroyed, power knocked out for thousands of people, and at least one person has died. Since the end of December, in fact, there has been significant seismic activity on the island. Puerto Rico is now in a state of emergency. Susan Huff is a seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in California. What is behind these destructive quakes in Puerto Rico lately?
Well, people are generally familiar with the Ring of Fire around the Pacific Rim and the active plate boundaries, and the Caribbean is essentially a small-scale Ring of Fire. So the Caribbean inside it is essentially one plate, and then the plates are moving around it. So you have different kinds of what we call plate boundaries that generate active earthquake zones, and everything in the Caribbean is essentially along that.
We are now approaching the 10-year anniversary this weekend of that massive quake in Haiti in 2010. Is the Caribbean at risk of another catastrophe at that scale anytime soon?
Yeah, that's the thing we can't predict. But if you look at the rates that the plates are moving, it's about half the rate that the Pacific plate is moving past the North American plate. So just as a broad brush statement, the hazard in the Caribbean is about half that in California. So it's not on a par with the most active places like Japan. But it's high enough. And sure, the earthquake hazard is a big concern for the region. There's a lot of islands that really aren't adequately prepared.
How hard is it to predict earthquakes?
Well, we can't predict the big ones, which is what everyone wants. And when's the 7 going to happen? When's the 8? But one thing we can do is forecast aftershock probabilities fairly well, drawing on established statistics. So that's been done for the Puerto Rico sequence.
What's the forecast for Puerto Rico then?
It's been an active sequence. So over the next year, the odds of another 5 are up at 98%.
Another 5
so
magnitude?
5 or greater, yeah. The odds of another 6 over the next year are around a third. The odds of a 7 are 4%, which is getting low. But and any big earthquake is always a low probability event. So a number like 4%, that's big enough to get our attention. It says that a 7 is unlikely, but it's possible. It's something that people need to be aware of. And another 6 is very possible.
Susan Huff is a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
You're with the world. Guatemalan parents give birth to a boy in the U.S., but they're undocumented, so they seek asylum in Canada.
I ain't gonna lie, but like I cried when I came here because like I'm so used to living in Detroit, and it felt weird for me.
Now Canada is prepared to deport the parents, so what to do with the kids who are American citizens? That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. President Trump today defended his decision to order the killing of Qasem Soleimani. He said the Iranian military commander was, quote, a monster. And Trump alluded to Soleimani planning future attacks, but he offered no new details or evidence of those plans. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill from both parties say they've been unimpressed with the White House's explanation for last week's attack in Baghdad. The House today debated a resolution to limit Trump's authority to wage war on Iran. Earlier, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the administration has been cavalier in its dealings with Congress.
It's stunning. And the president to say, oh, I inform you by reading my tweets. No, that's not the relationship that our founders had in mind in the Constitution of the United States when they gave power to the president, to the White House, to do one thing in terms of our national security and to the Congress to declare war and to allocate resources and the rest.
The United Nations has an office that reports on extrajudicial killings, and the head of that office tweeted that she is skeptical that the attack on Soleimani was a legitimate case of self-defense. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has been looking at some of the legal questions around all of this.
American tensions with Iran go back many years, at least to the hostage crisis of 1979. That said, we're where we are today because President Trump ordered the killing of the top military commander of the Islamic Republic. Can he just do that?
No, he really can't.
That's Ona Hathaway. She's a professor of international law at Yale University, and she says there are a number of reasons why he can't do that, involving international law, domestic statutes, and then there's the U.S. Constitution.
So the president is commander-in-chief under the U.S. Constitution, but he doesn't have the power to start wars. That power is given to the Congress.
Now, there are some exceptions, Hathaway says, the key one being if we're under attack.
The president should notify Congress and seek its consent as quickly as he can. But if, you know, really it's necessary to act and he doesn't have enough time to consult Congress, well, in that narrow instance, he can go ahead.
That's why you hear Trump administration officials saying things like this.
We reached the point where we had to act in self-defense.
Qasem Soleimani was actively plotting in the region to take actions, a big action as he described it, that would have put dozens, if not hundreds, of American lives at risk.
That was Pentagon Chief Mark Esper, followed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. But Hathaway says, legally speaking, it's not enough to say there's an imminent threat. A president has to show it, if not to the American people, then at least to Congress.
If he claims that he does not need to abide by the ordinary constitutional process, the burden is on him and those who work for him to explain why. And they really haven't done that.
So in this case, Hathaway says the killing of Soleimani was unconstitutional, but the political consensus in Washington is a whole other story. Regardless of what the Constitution says, American presidents for years have been using military force overseas. Congress has been fully on board, and the courts have refused to step in. Carrie Cordero is a national security lawyer and fellow at the Center for a New American Security.
Because the president's exercise of his war powers and his authority to use the use of force has not been something that Congress in recent history has asserted its own authority, that has provided flexibility for the executive branch to set the rules itself.
The executive branch under both Democratic and Republican administrations has determined that the Constitution gives the president broad authority as commander-in-chief. So he has the power to use force as long as it's in the national interest. And that, says Cordero, is close to a blank check.
It's very hard at this point to determine what type of action a president would take in this space that would not be in the national interest.
So from this point of view, Trump ordering the killing of Soleimani, someone with American blood on his hands, would be perfectly legal. And that seems to be the view taking hold among American lawmakers right now. Cordero says it would be easy for the Trump administration to craft a legal justification for killing Soleimani. The problem is, she says, they haven't bothered to.
It does not seem to be, based on anything that we have seen publicly yet, that the administration conducted a rigorous legal analysis in advance of the act.
Cordero says this is deeply troubling.
This is a country that operates on the rule of law. It is absolutely essential for the functioning of our democracy that that legal analysis be done and that they not be cherry-picking what sounds like the best legal arguments after the fact.
Ona Hathaway agrees, but for another reason.
Everybody is watching this exchange and want to see, you know, what is the basis the U.S. seems to think it has for killing a high-level government official of another sovereign state. And if it sort of shrugs its shoulders and seems to think it doesn't need to offer a good explanation, that opens the door to other states feeling like, well, maybe we can do the same thing.
And that, she says, is a very dangerous state of affairs. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The Trump administration recently hatched a highly unusual deportation plan. Mexican migrants who are denied asylum in the U.S. would be sent back to Guatemala. Guatemala's outgoing president, Jimmy Morales, said his administration never agreed to this. The plan appears to be on pause now. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins me to talk about this. This whole thing is kind of a head-scratcher, Monica. The president of Guatemala said the plan was actually false, never agreed to it. And now we hear the plan is on pause. So what is the plan? What is going on with it?
The plan is pretty drastic. It hasn't even been officially put on pause. I mean, this is all reporting that's coming out primarily from BuzzFeed. So we don't know. Is this going to be a week or two or a month?
If this plan were to proceed, what would this mean for Mexican asylum seekers? Would they all be vulnerable to getting deported to Guatemala?
It's unclear who exactly would be eligible to be deported to Guatemala. There are questions about that, including among migrants themselves. And I spoke with one father. His name is Ricardo Martinez, and he's waiting with his family and his young kids at a shelter in Ciudad Juarez, just across the border from El Paso, Texas. He knows about this possibility of being deported to Guatemala, and this is what he told me. He's saying there that he would not go back to Guatemala, that he would choose to remain in Mexico, but on the U.S.-Mexico border, on the Mexico side, they're not going to go back to the state that they came from in Mexico. That's not their option. They fled their home. What we could see is an increase of Mexicans internally displaced in their country on the Mexico side of the U.S. border.
So let's back up for a moment to how this all began. What did the U.S. and Guatemala originally agree on?
This summer, Guatemala and the U.S. initially agreed that Guatemala would accept some asylum seekers who had reached the U.S.-Mexico border and been rejected, that those people could be sent, deported to Guatemala instead. And the understanding is that it would mostly involve Hondurans and people from El Salvador, people who'd crossed through Guatemala on their way up to the United States.
But, I mean, the fact remains, Guatemala is still not a safe place to go.
Absolutely. It has the same conditions. If you're leaving Honduras and you go to Guatemala, you're thinking, why am I in Guatemala? I'm facing the same types of gang violence, murder rates, corruption, poverty that I did back in Honduras or elsewhere. I spoke to one person, Rick Jones. He's a migration expert with Catholic Relief Services. And he said that, you know, this just puts people who are fleeing dangerous conditions into similar dangerous conditions.
If they're sent back to Guatemala, they're going to be housed in some of the more risky neighborhoods. And the longer you're there, the greater the likelihood that something bad will happen to you. People will be sent back to a place where they don't have friends, they don't have family, they don't have a social network, and the government doesn't have any capacity to protect its own citizens, let alone new citizens that are coming into the country, or Mexican citizens that are coming into the country. So I think this is really why it makes this such a bad idea.
Monica, what are you going to be looking for next in this story?
I'll be looking for how negotiations go with the next president of Guatemala, whether this expansion, including Mexican migrants, actually will happen. I'll also be speaking with migrants themselves. People who are leaving Central America often have very strong ties in the United States. So going to Guatemala isn't an option for them. They've got work and families in the United States waiting for them. So they will find a way in, and they will try to find a way in. And I'll be definitely speaking to people to see how they are also negotiating and thinking about what's next for them.
Monica Campbell, the world's immigration editor, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Over the past 3 years, Canada has seen a spike in requests for asylum. Many of the immigrants have been coming from the United States, including undocumented immigrants who have traveled north with their children who were born in the U.S. As Canada decides the asylum cases for the parents, it is also deciding the futures of those kids who are American citizens. Emma Jacobs reports from Mississauga, Ontario, that it's creating some painful dilemmas for those families.
When she was 13, Sandra Morales moved to Detroit with her sister. She went on to work and to meet her husband, Daniel Roblero. Like her, he'd left Guatemala as a teenager. They didn't have legal status in the U.S., but their six kids were all American citizens. And the family never thought about leaving until the election of President Donald Trump in 2016.
Cuando empezó a decir que él iba a hacer las leyes muy duras contra los inmigrantes.
When he started to say there would be stronger laws against immigrants, Morales says her husband told her, "I'm afraid. If I get caught again, what's going to become of the children if they catch you? What will the children do and where will they be sent?" Roblero has brothers in Canada who encouraged him to come. Plus, he'd heard about the country's welcoming attitude towards refugees. So the family decided to head to Canada in March 2017. The oldest son, Gimder, was in high school.
I ain't gonna lie, but I cried when I came here because, like, I'm so used to living in Detroit. I never came here, too. Like, it was my first time coming here, and it felt weird for me.
After arriving in Ontario, the family applied for asylum, the Guatemalan parents and their American children. Andrew Brower, a refugee lawyer with Legal Aid of Ontario, says they're not the only ones in this situation.
We've seen more U.S. citizen kids coming to Canada together with their non-U.S. citizen parents.
As many as 1,800 kids since 2017, according to government statistics. The Canadian government is working through a backlog of asylum applications, but it's likely many will be denied. For mixed nationality families, that means a painful choice. Take their American children back to their home country or split the family up. Morales says she'd seen a lot of comments that Canada is a country that tries to keep families together, and she'd wanted to believe this. But Canada's Immigration and Refugee Board denied her family's asylum request, saying they hadn't proven they were specifically targeted by violence in Guatemala. The father, Daniel Roblero, was deported in November. That left Morales alone with her kids in Canada and her own impending deportation date. The family Skypes in the evenings. Morales says her youngest, her five-year-old son, doesn't understand why his dad is in Guatemala.
I'm so sad when I hear my baby say, please drop me at school, pick it up me, if I don't come. So it's really hard.
The day we met at a church near the Toronto airport, Morales and Gimder had just come from a meeting with a Canadian border officer. Gimder is 18 now. And the family had asked if the younger children could return to Detroit with him.
It was going to be hard because like, I had to work, drop out, you know, out of school and start working. But I don't know. I will never give up. And like, I'll do anything for my siblings.
They also have relatives in Detroit who agreed to help out.
Pero ellos dijeron que no, que se tienen que ir conmigo.
But Morales says the border agency said no, that they thought the younger children would be safer in Guatemala with her. Canada's Customs and Border Services Agency says it can't comment on specific cases, but that should there be a question that the family member is not willing and capable to safely care for the unaccompanied minor, the CBSA will make arrangements on a case-by-case basis.
Yo también lo pienso que sí. Solo que la vida
Morales says she also sometimes thinks her children might be better off with her in Guatemala. But then she says life is so difficult there and sometimes dangerous. She worries about gangs and extortion. She says having lived in North America can make someone a target.
They think they have a lot of money because they live a long time there. That's why I'm scared.
The refugee attorney, Brower, says the CBSA doesn't set out to overrule parents.
Parents are understood to be acting in the best interest of their kids. So if the parent says that the kids should go to a different country from where they're going, and the kids have the right to go there, generally CBSA would be expected to take that into account.
But he says with the agency's goal to deport people quickly, families may not get what they want without help from an advocate. Morales says she knows they took a risk leaving the U.S. to come here.
Sometimes I think it's a bad idea to come to Canada, but...
She switches to Spanish.
Pero no pierdo las esperanzas.
She says, I haven't lost hope that I could stay because I like this country. It's a beautiful country for my children, too. Morales' deportation date was set for February 2020. But about a week ago, the agency called to say they'd postponed her departure while they reviewed her case. That review could take weeks or months. Meanwhile, her husband remains in Guatemala. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Mississauga, Ontario.
By the way, you can get an early start with us right at the beginning of your day. Our morning newsletter, Top of the World, gets you going with fresh details from stories we're covering across the globe. Sign up by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. That's theworld.org/newsletters. President Trump has vowed that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon under his watch. Well, here's one approach to stop that from happening.
When they assigned her to me, it was my idea to send her to Iran, get her into the nuclear division. Her cover? An English and French teacher.
I'm probably not going to sleep tonight.
You're going to do great. You're the best person for this assignment.
That's the trailer for the Israeli film The Operative. A British woman gets recruited by the Israeli spy agency Mossad and is sent to Tehran. Yuval Adler is an Israeli filmmaker who wrote and directed The Operative. He joins us from New York. So what's really interesting here is this is an Israeli spy movie supported by the Israeli government, and you film parts of it in the streets of Tehran. How'd you manage to pull that off?
Yeah, that was quite a fit. It's not just an Israeli production. It's also French and German. But, like, of course, there's a strong Israeli component. I really wanted to have shots from the streets of Tehran. So what we did is first, before the shoot, our DP went there.
Director of photography.
He's German. So he went in like a tourist and he shot a lot of stuff. And then later on, our German producer got another German company to hire a French company to hire local people in Iran to shoot high definition footage in the streets according to very specific specifications without them knowing what it is for.
Wow.
And even the French company didn't know what it's for. So in a way, it was like in espionage called false flag, that, you know, you don't say who you are when you're doing transactions. And I think that also protected them, because the people in Iran or the French people who were in the middle, they were just being professionals and got a job to shoot. No, it's not like we needed to shoot military installations. We just needed to shoot, you know, streets.
Was it all about authenticity? I mean, why did you do this?
It's not all in Iran. A lot of it takes place in Germany, but like, it's just, you want to be able to put Diane in the streets, and we managed to do it. I mean, we managed to actually shoot her in Sofia sometimes when the streets are very similar, and then
in Bulgaria.
In Bulgaria, yeah, and then digitally insert Iran as part of the shots.
Right, and you shot a body double from the back for the Iran scenes, I gather.
Yeah.
So, Yuval, let's talk about the film. The plot is, as I said, this new operative played by Diane Kruger. She's recruited by Israel's intel service, Mossad, and she's ostensibly in Tehran to teach English and French. She's actually there to spy. We know the conflict between Israel and Iran is not just on the battlefield. There have been many attempts to infiltrate Iran's nuclear program. There's one scene in the movie where Kruger's character is hacking into a server of an Iranian company with ties to the regime. And I'm just wondering, how much of what we see in the movie is based on your imagination and how much is based on your research with former Mossad agents?
When you speak to Mossad agents about very specific and highly sensitive issues, the best you can get is kind of, you know, the O.J. book, If I Did It?
Yeah, O.J. Simpson's book about his perspective on the murders.
So it's like, if he did it, that's how it would happen, right? That's what you can get from them. They say, I can't tell you that I did it. I can't tell you this, but I can tell you that if I did it, that makes sense.
Gotcha.
And I say, what about that? And they would say, oh, that doesn't make sense. You know, when there was all this stuff about Stuxnet.
That was a virus that was allegedly implanted by Israel in the U.S. to infiltrate the nuclear program in Iran.
Yeah, so when you read about it, or if you see the documentary, 0 days, right?
0 days, yeah. I think David Sanger of the New York Times was involved in it.
You know, they say, well, we put this thing and we developed this worm and all that stuff. But then we needed to put it in somewhere, and the Israelis kind of managed that with one of their assets. And I was thinking, who is this asset? Like, who did it for them? When I talk to people, it's not necessarily you have to put it in a very sensitive place. In the film, she's not in a very sensitive place. You know what I mean? She's not a super spy. Again, they couldn't, nobody came and said, yes, that's how we did it with Stuxnet. But I got a sense that it's something like that.
If there are people listening to us now in Iran, do you have a message for them?
The film is not a message of peace or a message of, you know, I don't do this kind of stuff. But I think it does show something about this shadow war between Israel, the U.S. and Iran looks like. Mm. You know what I mean? What is this low intensity conflict look like on the espionage level? So I think people will like that aspect of it, especially now when this thing is, you know, happening in the news.
Yuval Adler, the filmmaker behind The Operative, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sometimes a song says it all. And we'll never be royal. The tune by Lorde can soon be reality for Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. The World's Jonathan Dyer has the latest on the Great Royal Rift.
News of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle stepping back as senior members of the royal family has made headlines around the world.
And Declaration of Independence, the frenzied reaction to Prince Harry and Meghan's...
This comes amidst reports of, rifts between both Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
Meghan Pangeran Harry and Meghan Markle melalui akun Instagram.
This royal resignation begs the question, can they even do that? And if so, how? Well, you might want to start by clearing it with the boss first. That's Harry's grandmother, the Queen to you and me. Here's BBC Royal Correspondent Johnny Diamond.
Multiple sources at the palace have told the BBC that no members of the royal family were consulted about this by Harry and Meghan. There is talk of disappointment. There is talk of senior members of the royal family being hurt. And the openness about a division between the palace and between Harry and Meghan is breathtaking.
When the palace says the Queen is displeased, that's code for absolutely bleeping furious. Harry and Meghan have been transparent that being a royal couple isn't all high tea and jewels. They have been the subject of intense tabloid media interest, and Meghan, as a biracial American, came in for particular scrutiny. Just a few months ago, she told ITV she was, quote, not okay.
You add this on top of just trying to be a new mom or trying to be a newlywed. It's a very real thing to be going through behind the scenes.
Author and playwright Bonnie Greer has previously pointed to the fact that Meghan and Harry are not afraid to make their own path. And everyone, she said, needs to let that happen.
What we need to do, I think, is to be mindful, and I mean that, about the streak that's going through this country right now, or this nativist streak, and let them find their feet and let her just be who she is.
BBC royal correspondent Johnny Diamond has joined Harry and Meghan on their royal engagements. He said he's seen the couple's displeasure at royal duties firsthand.
There were great chunks of the job they simply didn't like. Harry came alive with the big crowds, but he hated the ceremonial and he couldn't bear the cameras. Meghan said she didn't want to be a voiceless figurehead, but in fact, whenever she spoke up, she got criticised for it. There were just too much about being a frontline royal they don't like.
Their new website, sussexroyal.com, which launched yesterday, details which royal duties the couple will keep doing. They'll still work with charities and even make their own charity. They will keep their newly renovated house in Windsor as a UK base and keep their police protection, which leaves many saying they're having their taxpayer-funded cake and eating it too. Harry, Meghan and their son Archie plan to spend half their time in North America, most likely Canada. But if they think this plea for independence from the rest of the royal family will free them from British tabloid attention, today's headlines might make them think again. For The World, I'm Jonathan Dyer.
And from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.